out of the black of the western sky, moored in the gently undulating sea of electromagnetic radiation, and otherwise, from an undisclosable location for reasons of security and therefore insecurity, this is Coast to Coast AM. Good evening, everybody. John B. Wells sitting in with you tonight for the second time I've ever sat in with you on Saturday night in my life and yours. And we have a program lined up for you tonight that I think that you will like. For the first hour, James Childs will be with us. He's been on Coast to Coast many times. He writes and lectures on technology and wrote Inviting Disaster, Lessons from the Edge of Technology, all the way back to 2001. And much of his writing has dealt with system malfunctions. In other words, he studies things that foul up. And do we ever need him now? So we'll be talking to him very shortly. And then, second, third, and fourth hour, along with some of your calls, if you like, Dr. Lawrence Krauss, who has this idea that science and God cannot coexist. One has little or nothing to do with the other. So we wish a hearty en garde to the doctor and look forward to speaking with him. This should be a lot of fun. A lot of crazy stuff happening in the news. Be sure and check the Coast to Coast website, don't you know, because there is there are some interesting things on there, as always. Zoologer, unique life form is half plant, half animal. I knew some of those people in school, didn't you? Just kidding. Astronomers weigh in on the Milky Way's true colors. UFO news, the Argentinian OVNI footage is enhanced. And the Phobos Grunt crashes to Earth. That satellite is coming down, I guess, sometime between now and tomorrow night. So we'll just see what happens. This story will tweak some people up a little bit. But let's go ahead and lock and load. This week's revelation by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention that homicide is no longer the leading cause or among the leading causes of death in the U.S. at a time when gun ownership is at an all-time high. Shows that the gun ban lobby has been wrong, the Citizens Committee for the Right to Keep and Bear Arms said today. The CDC's report for 2010 that removes homicide from the top 15 leading causes of death in this country coincides with a period of record high gun ownership. Well, as I say, better to have it and not need it than to need it and not have it. And I'll tell you, there's nothing that'll thwart an assault, a robbery, or a homicide quite like the possibility that you may be the victim, you being the perpetrator. The Italian cruise ship, that situation is getting worse and worse, or the cruise ship that's trying to capsize off the Italian coast. As a matter of fact, James Childs will speak with us about that. And several other things, asteroids, all sorts of things that we can't really deal with personally, but perhaps our collective consciousness will chill them out just a little bit. So let us just say, all hands, man your receptor stations. Rig mothership for suborbital sustained inverted flight as we turn the contents upside down. This is Charlie 2, Charlie Alpha Mike. That's Flyboy Talk for Coast to Coast AM. The Phobos Grunt is probe launched by Russian space agency Roscosmos, due to land on Phobos, one of the moons in Mars, you know, ordered to collect soil samples, test atmosphere, possibly discover some weaponizable bacteria to bring back to Mother Earth, search for signs of life. Carrying small capsule of microorganisms intended to test how well they cope with long-distance space travel. However, might be good that the luck didn't hold out, because what if they morphed into something weird? Mr. Childs, are you there? What's the matter with this thing? Why is it coming back in this unplanned and sort of unstable fashion?
Hi, John.
How are you?
I'm doing fine. Yeah, I'd love to be up there and peek in on it before it burns up.
Well, I'll tell you what, from some of the adventures I've been reading about that you've had, I can just imagine you would like to be up there.
But not too long, because it's going to have a hot ride down. Like I say, some estimates tomorrow afternoon, Eastern time. But it's definitely coming down about 10 kilometers a day, so there is really no question that its time is up. And why this happened is... there's some speculation on it. Scientists have some theories, and conspiracy theorists have others. I believe it was probably due to tumbling, where it couldn't recharge its batteries, but certainly it had some really poor communication strategies up there.
So it's not Israel.
Well, unless the Israel is an interesting space station because it moves its spacecraft opposite everybody else. It launches to the west rather than to the east. So it makes it kind of an interesting trajectory. But the Phobos Grunt, they tried to fix it in November, couldn't do it, couldn't even hardly talk with it. They don't have the, are you familiar with the TDRS, the U.S. Network of Satellite Communications?
Only vaguely.
It's a network of that allows us to talk to satellites and the space station nearly all the time. Until we had that, we had very poor communication, kind of like the Russians have now. So they were relying on actual amateurs to tell them what the satellite was doing.
Now, is this network for purposes of tasking them and then retasking them? Is that what you mean by communicating with them?
Yeah, it's kind of our, imagine a telephone system for satellites. That's what TDRS is.
Okay.
Tracking and data relay satellites. That's how we talk to the International Space Station. Because otherwise, you know, we wouldn't be able to point our antennas at it from the ground very often. So Russians don't have that, and that was one of the problems they faced in trying to figure out what the heck was wrong. They were communication challenged.
You've been on the show many times, and this is the first opportunity that you and I have had to speak, so we're doing it between ourselves and also with several million of our closest friends, as I like to say.
But, and I'm happy to do it. I hope for more conversations, too.
Well, me too. Now, is it just an oversimplification to say you study things that you're sort of a failure analyst of systems and of various systems from space to elevators? Is that close?
That's from way down deep to way up high. But I do like to get the message in of real life heroes, of people that saw into the machine, saw the trouble brewing, and acted in time. I tried to get the History Channel to have an extra show in my series about that, about the heroes. But instead, you know, it's the stuff that blows up or burns up, the things that make the video. So I go on and do that myself on talks like this or in lectures about who are the heroes, who do we look to, who will pull us out of the fire, who do we lead, which leaders do we follow. That's what I'm particularly interested in.
What are the top two or three or four or five or how many you got? What are the things that are really getting your attention these days?
Well, these days, one is Lessons from the Titanic, by golly, 100 years ago, helping out on a History Channel show on that. It'll be out in April. And so that's why I was interested in the Costa Concordia, because of its evacuation lessons. So that's a subject that's near and dear to my heart, evacuation, people under stress. How do they perform when things are so confusing? Have you ever been in a fire evacuation, John, anything like that, where you had to get out in a hurry?
No, actually, I have not. I mean, I've had to get out of there in a hurry for other reasons, but not because the building was on fire.
It's that's a good thing, because sometimes people don't make it out. I call that the last great adventure on Earth, something you can't buy yourself into when the machines are going crazy, sort of like Three Mile Island. They call it an alarm storm. Have you heard that term before?
Once or twice, yes, I have.
An alarm storm is when the whole panel lights up. Flight 447, that had an alarm storm over the Atlantic, and it's really hard to keep your head in a situation like that.
The panel's telling you that everything is going wrong.
Yes.
Are we under control? Stand by, please. We are experiencing a temporary communications malfunction. And when Mr. Childs comes back, we will study it. In the meantime, as far as this cruise ship is concerned, the captain has been arrested. So I'm wondering if it's another Exxon Valdez situation. How are we doing, David? We have lost the man. Oh, this is not good. Well, so much for communicating with the satellite. I think we're getting a first-hand dose of exactly what happened to Grunt Phobos. There is no communication now. Satellite will tumble out of control and head toward Earth. Run for huts. Landing site is not predictable at this point. One of the things, I'll just tell you about this. Space. Oh, is he back?
I'm back.
He's back. Okay, excellent. I was just about to go into the casting a high-tech net for space trash, but let's go back to the alarm storm.
It's kind of a modern problem. Didn't have it back in the steam engine days. It's where, and surgeons, I was giving a talk to Mayo Clinic, and surgeons said they have them too. So many alarms, and people put them in there, I guess, because the lawyers want them to, the manufacturers. And it doesn't take much at all for those to go off, and then they tend to set off other alarms. And it's really hard to know how it started and how to stop it. And it can be very, very off-putting, you know, if other things are, if particularly the situation is unclear, like on Flight 447. As far as the Costa Concordia, we don't know what was going on the bridge. All we know is the captain said, by golly, there was a reef there that I never saw before. And others say, well, you were in the wrong area. Maybe that's, you shouldn't even been looking for that reef.
Oh, boy.
You were way off course. So probably not an alarm storm in that case, but I speculate maybe a power failure on the ship. That's possible.
So once you have the alarm storm, it's pretty, is it then tricky to find out, well, where did this start? In other words, if every red light is on the panel, and you didn't notice the sequence by which they came on, is that the problem now? You're just dealing with everything at once, and you can't even go back to...
That's right. That's one problem, is where did it start? Well, depending on which field you're in, for example, if you're an airline pilot, the rule is fly the plane. Do not allow yourself to get distracted, because that's happened a great many times in a lot of airline crashes, where everybody on the flight deck starts worrying about a light bulb or some little glitch, rather than thinking, where is this plane? How high is it? Is it level? Where is it going? And it's most likely to happen at night. That's where these problems usually happen. So someone is supposed to watch the plane and not get excited. And there are times the instruments go bad on you, but you normally have some frame of reference, and you must keep your eye on that frame of reference and not be distracted. It's at least one person on the flight deck needs to keep their head.
Let me ask you something. When you remember that those two 747s that ran into each other in the, what was it, the Canary Islands some years ago?
Tenerife, yes.
Yeah. How does something like that happen? Is that one of those things that the odds just compel to happen? Obviously, it's a cascading series of unfortunate events.
Well, let me speak generally on the subject. Is called runway incursions, and those can happen many ways. Again, most likely to happen at night, but not necessarily. On the ground, the runways and taxiways are kind of confusing, particularly for a pilot who hasn't been to an airport before. And you can have the ground controllers sending them in the wrong directions or not telling them to hold when they should. It's a compounding, just like you say, a compounding of little things. Pilots take off on the wrong runway, you know, a closed runway. You know, how could they possibly do that? Well, it's late, they're tired. They don't notice the cues that they're on the wrong runway. So they assume too much. That's the problem. You just, they're not, the brains aren't turning. They're just going through routine.
You know, when I took my check ride with the FAA designated examiner, he was and still is. I don't know, if maybe within the last year or two he's retired, but he was the oldest living designated examiner on the North American continent. He flew Lockheed Hudsons in World War II for the Canadian Air Force because the Army Air Force didn't want him. It was more of a country club in those days.
Wow.
And he asked the question, who do you think makes more mistakes, the controllers or the pilots? And I said, sounds like I should say pilots, but I don't think so. I'm going to guess controllers. He said, that's exactly right. He goes, you're on your own, and you need to verify and check because they're human beings and they make mistakes.
Yes.
And so I suppose that was the situation with this.
I remember my instructor, pilot, he said, when I made a mistake, you have to acknowledge that you've messed it up, that you've boogered it. And once I admitted that, then we could go on with the test. But he said, you have to acknowledge when you've made a mistake.
Absolutely, and communicate it. You must confess. And just, you know, if you're in trouble, you just have to tell ATC, I got a problem here. I need vectors. I need vectors, directions. I need, just tell me what to do. Which makes me wonder what happened with young John Kennedy. He was a new pilot, but he wasn't an incompetent pilot. Do you have any theory on what actually happened to him? Because that was really Seems to me like it set the autopilot and request vectors.
And what was the ground fog situation? Wasn't that out of sea, kind of a little a loss of horizon?
Yes.
But it was daytime, as I recall. You wonder how could anybody lose their way in the daytime? But it's, you know, it's possible to not have a very good ground reference and maybe just not be paying attention. That's the only theory I have. Not realizing that the situation you're in is, it's not transparently dangerous, but it really is dangerous. So that's that edge of the seat. I've talked with a bush pilot up in Alaska, and he talked about when he landed on a mountain, he would get his rear end up off the seat and just kind of get the circulation going down there, because he said he needed that for his part of his instruments was to know if the plane was getting light in the air. So he used every sense that he had, because he was really on his own landing on the Arctic mountains. So he was under no illusions of safety, and I think that's maybe one problem with the modern world, is that it seems fully under control. But I can tell you so many cases, and I'm sure you've heard of many yourself, where it was not safe at all. People just thought it was. Well, here's one example from the thing I'm watching with the Costa Concordia, is their escape modeling. Are you familiar with software evacuation models?
Yes.
Yeah, push a button and it says how people will behave.
Right.
And that's, you know, they used to test airliners by actually hiring people to shove their way out of a darkened airliner. And sometimes people broke their arms, and that's not favored practice anymore, but it was realistic. Now we use software models. And I don't know how much I trust them, but I'm curious, because they use them in the cruise industry now, software models for evacuation. So I'm just curious, how did that, what did it say people would do when the ship was listing up to 80 degrees? How are they going to get out of there?
I don't know. I wonder sometimes how intelligent it really is to categorize behavior and then assume that your profile is accurate. I mean, there
like
is that
molecule.
Human.
It assumes you're like a molecule of water. They actually think of pipes, you know, and it, in some cases it may be just fine. It's, but only within a certain boundary. And well, one thing, it should be obvious to any modeler, I don't know if they include this, that people stop and look for their families. They did that in the World Trade Center. People could have evacuated, no, they wanted to talk to their families, want to communicate with them. Even though their families weren't in the building, you need that reassurance to find your group, and that slows evacuation, but also that's just the way people are. You can't talk them out of it in a high-stress situation. So modelers need to allow for that. You have to. It's called sense-making. There's a term called sense-making where you, under high stress, you try to come up with a theory of a world that's really upside down. And hopefully that's a correct sense-making. Sometimes it's not. But that's why I put my book out there. People are a little bit... have one more tool to help them make sense of strange events.
Tell us about the book a little bit.
Well, it came out in 2001, Inviting Disaster, still in print. I give talks on the subject and enjoy going around different fields, engineers, surgeons, technicians, mechanics, and hearing their stories, their interpretation, boilermakers. I had a real interesting talk with boilermakers recently about red flags, things that alert them that a machine is in a dangerous state or somebody's not taking care of a boiler. So that subject of red flags got my attention, and may do more with that in the future. The red flag. So it's a book is still out there, and then I did a book in 2007 on helicopters called The God Machine.
The God Machine.
So I am watching the stories from the Costa Concordia about their use of helicopters to evacuate a few dozen people on the ship. So that subject of evacuation comes up again, and rescue by helicopter.
What are the reports on loss of life at this point?
This point, three is the number of souls lost I've seen, and there's 40 unaccounted for. But given the confusion, if you've seen the photos, you know that's almost on the rocks. It's very close to the island, and so people were picked up by boat, by helicopter. They swam, and in those situations, it's pretty hard to actually count the heads. So I'm surprised there are only 40 unaccounted for.
All right. When we come back, let's talk about maybe you have some experience with the 1965, back when dinosaurs roamed the Earth, at New York City blackout. I wonder what the potential is for it now with these magnetic storms and so forth. And anything else that you'd like to talk about, I'm always ready to study something that's just about to bite us. This is Coast to Coast AM. We shall return. Well, how about some more Greek? We're going to come back with James Childs here in just a moment and take a couple of your calls if you would like. And you know the numbers, so dial them. This is Coast to Coast AM. We shall return in a moment. James Childs, why don't we talk about the Titanic here for a minute?
Hi, John. What do you want to launch into that, or do you want to talk a little bit about solar flares? And
you know, let's do the solar flare thing first, because I certainly you must be looking at. Let me ask you a question, because I don't know the answer to this, and you know, somebody famous said it's better to just keep quiet and be thought a fool than open your mouth and remove all doubt, right?
Yeah, Dwayne.
Do any of your studies involve the geopolitical ramifications of system failures?
They do. It's at the core of my concern.
Excellent.
Which is, do we really take this grid for granted?
Yes.
I see it as we're sort of living at the top of a tower that is not quite as firm as it feels on an ordinary day. And we see when there are shocks, things like the Kobe earthquake that disrupts the supply chain, or floods in Thailand, that we're much more interconnected than we used to be. And it's a whole new world with many people dependent on artificial fertilizer. We certainly couldn't live off land like we used to. There's too many people to do that. So I guess that my message to readers is, don't take this for granted. We all have to play a part in keeping this ship afloat, as it were. And sometimes the humble people are the eyes that save the rest of us. Repairmen see things, report it, and the experts say, oh my gosh, I'm glad you saw that. So I'm hoping to encourage people, and I'm a cheerleader. Know your world, this strange, kind of strange new world that we live in. I find it fascinating. It's kind of scary, too.
It's a little bit scary. Do you put stock into this magnetic pole shift, grid collapse, solar flares causing a widespread chaos to coincide with the end of the Mayan calendar, any of that, or are you strictly pragmatic about it?
I'm not a Mayan guy, but I do think the subject of coronal mass ejections, along with pulse weapons, is something that I don't think it would necessarily bring down the whole grid, but it could certainly cause some major disruptions. We've been in a fortunate time ever since the 1970s, where we had fairly low solar mass ejections, but that's an aberration. It was a giant one, I want to say in the 1850s, just a humongous coronal mass ejection. So that kind of thing would cause major problems. You know, to oversimplify greatly, the grid acts like an antenna. If this induced current, can certainly blow out a lot of things. And to pick up on your question, this whole subject of SCADA gear, which is the supervisory control and data acquisition, that's made the grid somewhat more vulnerable than it used to be. It's more efficient, but it's more vulnerable. I mean, you have power plants that don't even have an engineer at them anymore. They're run by remote, and that kind of thing could be worsened by a coronal mass ejection. So I wouldn't say I'm an alarmist or scaremonger, but just because we've had it good in the past doesn't mean we'll have it good in the future.
Well, the odds compel it. The odds would seem to compel some sort of a noticeable, something worth writing in the history books. But I'll tell you what, I've never heard anybody say it exactly like you said it. So the power generating apparatus actually acts as an antenna and winds up being overloaded
the wire, the high voltage wires. And I've been up and close and personal with a 250,000 volt line on a helicopter. We actually bonded to that line. When that New Zealand balloon went down the other day, it made me reflect, you know, why exactly did that thing explode, you know, where 11 people were killed. But we didn't have any accidents, fortunately, because we were in a helicopter, a bunch of really expert guys who needed to work on the power line. And it was live, of course. It was an energized line. We all wore conductive suits. Yeah. And anyway, if you know what you're doing, then the system can be pretty safe. But you really have to have an expert by your side.
As far as our power generation is concerned in this country, have you taken a look at the nuclear facilities?
Yes, and some of them are run better than others, I must say. I know New Yorkers would be happy if Indian Point packed up and moved away, not necessarily because I think it's an unsafely run, but it's pretty close to New York City. And I think the lesson of Fukushima Daiichi was, people who had nothing at all to do, nothing to gain from those nuclear reactors. I mean, they're thrown out of their house and home. And, you know, I saw the article in National Geographic about people living in boxes in the floors of gymnasiums. That doesn't seem very fair to be run off from their property like that.
Based on the information that you, based on the information that you have, and you're liable to hear anything out there, is there any reason to think that Tokyo is at risk and will eventually have to be? I heard this 2 weeks ago maybe more, that Tokyo will eventually have to be evacuated to some degree. Are you hearing any of that?
Well, I was there about a year and a half ago with my boys, and so I was looking around as we toured. What a fabulous city! Just really enjoyed it to pieces. I loved it. It's not very high off the ocean, and I'd say that's my main concern is. Were there another big timber, like the Sendai, but closer to Tokyo, it would take a giant hit. Now, there are some tidal barriers, but they're not meant to take a tsunami. So, I don't know. I guess you could say they're living on that edge of the volcano, as it were. So, now we all, you know, L.A., people put up with risk, feel that it won't happen while I'm here, and we rationalize it. Have to go on. But yeah, it'll be on my mind if I lived in Tokyo, yes. Not so much an earthquake directly, but the tsunami.
Well, supposedly there have been 14,000 extra deaths since that Fukushima problem occurred, and mostly children ages one and under. So the radiation seems to be migrating slowly this way, but not enough to cause a general alarm.
It's quite a distance, and certainly there was that alarm about the water supply. Recall that. And that, I believe, was Tokyo's northern reservoirs. You know, there were some radiation hits that caused a good deal of alarm in the city. So it's just its distance doesn't necessarily make it safe. But if I... And I'd be happy to go back to Tokyo anytime. I don't feel it's unsafe at all. I think its risks are more from other events rather than from, because the plume from Fukushima Daiichi mostly went to the northwest rather than to the southwest, which would be where Tokyo is.
I wonder what's become of the 20 million tons of debris that was floating toward our west coast.
Oh, the great blob. I've heard next roughly 18 months, and it'll start arriving. Quite a bit of it is sunk. But gosh, how odd it would be in Long Beach to see a house come in your direction.
Oh.
There probably are, you know, large structures that heading towards the West Coast. I think they're already about at Midway, those pieces.
Now, that stuff should be relatively decontaminated over that period of time after being washed continuously with salt water, wouldn't you think?
Yes, soaked and dispersed.
So it's not like some green glowing blob is going to show up, you know?
No, it would be
at the beach.
It would be pretty desanitized, but still has a lot of threat, mainly to marine mammals, birds, fish. That would be my main concern. And tremendous amount of debris when it finally lands somewhere. Yeah, 20 million tons. It may have been more than that. Just stunning images of that mucky wave going out to sea with all those houses and cars in it. What a pile of junk.
Unbelievable. Say, what about space junk? Should we go down to the local pawn shop and see if we can find ourselves some Kevlar helmets to wear? Or?
Well, it's there's not that much of it up there. I did a rough calculation one time when I was doing an article for Smithsonian, and it's like one piece in thousands of cubic miles. Unfortunately, it's moving very fast. But I found the subject very interesting. I didn't find much hope in going up there and taking it down because it is so dispersed at such a high velocity. But there might be lasers or some kind of energetic. Of course, that'd also be a weapon. There might be some beam that could deorbit them. That's quite possible. But I can't imagine an actual spacecraft zipping around and picking them up like a garbage truck. I don't think that's at all practical. But it is a real hazard. That's the biggest single hazard to the International Space Station is debris. Statistically, that's the hazard. I saw a hypervelocity gun fired at White Sands, the test range there, to check out armor for the International Space Station. About 12 years ago, fires objects at 7 miles a second.
Was that all?
Now they test the Whipple shields. It's called a Whipple shield. That's what helps keep the astronauts safe up there. But not the big pieces, just the little pieces.
Is that like the latest evolution of the electric, the thing they used to call the rail gun?
They use a kind of it's called a hydrogen gas gun. It's a powder charge, and then it's super boosted by a hydrogen fuel. They did not have a rail gun there, but I think in the future, by golly, they'd use a rail gun. They said that if they didn't fire it into a chamber and fired it towards the hills, you know, you would see this spectacular bolt of light as the object, about like a 50 caliber, about that diameter, burned up in the atmosphere. They said it would really make quite a show, but they didn't do that. They were just testing the armor. But it was a fun place to be.
Indeed.
So it didn't make me horribly alarmed, but I think astronauts might be more concerned about eye damage and other long-term health issues associated with being in space. But there's no shortage of volunteers. They love to be up there, and they love to go on to Mars. So I guess you could say they know the risk and they accept that.
Do you have much insight into the United States Air Force Space Command and whether or not there's more going on up there than we know?
Well, I did visit the perimeter acquisition radar in North Dakota, which is one of their prime eyes in the sky. That's on the plains of North Dakota on the eastern side. So that's the big radar they use for looking at objects up in space. It's a phased array radar, if you know what that is.
Yes.
And they joked when I was there about spotting aliens, but they were just joking. They said they hadn't seen anything that they would like to tell me about. There's an interesting device along the southern tier of states, United States. It's called the FENCE. Have you heard of that?
I have not.
It's basically an electromagnetic field that's been running for years. It's sort of like imagine a sheet of energy that runs from roughly San Diego to Georgia, and it goes up in space. And so it beeps, basically causes a beep every time an object passes through. So it's not like radar. It's more like an electromagnetic field that things beep when they go through. They use that for statistical studies of space debris. So I guess you could say we have a glimmering of what's up there. But, you know, when you read these estimates of softball-sized debris, nobody really knows. That's just a radar reflection. They say it's softball size. That's just a theoretical thing. Nobody has looked at that object in detail. There are telescopes that can catch the streaks, but they're really too small to see from hundreds of miles away.
What is your expertise in research indicate to you might be the ramifications of projects like, Project HARP and this
Russians said, you destroyed our probe, you darn Amerikonskis. At least one Russian said that.
Really?
I don't see that as any kind of an explanation for what went wrong with Phobos Grunt.
Do you see it as any kind of a threat to the environment eventually with these various fields that they're laying up there and all these, you know, billions of watts of electromagnetic radiation being focused in a beam and
if
shooting it out all over the place?
And they warned me that at the perimeter acquisition radar up in North Dakota. They said you certainly wouldn't want to stand in front of this thing because it's about 30 megawatts. It's similar to being, you know, you'd be standing in a microwave, an open door of a microwave, but it fades away over the distance of miles. You just wouldn't want to fly in front of it. So I guess my answer would be it has a near-term acute risk to somebody right in the beam, but I don't, and it's some might say a big waste of energy. But on the other hand, I don't see any threat. I didn't feel a threat anyway when I was there.
Well, what's the biggest object on your scope at present?
Automation. It's the dangers of automation. It's complacency of, you know, we talked a little earlier about the alarm storm, but it's more a feeling that the machine will do it, and just year by year, our ability to control the machine lapses. So when finally the autopilot hands it over to us and says, I'm done. This thing's full of ice. It's yours. That's about the worst possible time to take over from an autopilot, and that's happened more than a few times. Now, pitot tubes, I mean, now they don't just cause problems with the airspeed. It actually can cause computer problems. That happened with the B-2 crash several years ago. The computer got bad readings from what acts as a pitot tube in the B-2 bomber, and basically took over from the pilots and caused it to stall, and they had to punch out. So it used to be a pitot would just tell you the wrong airspeed, but now it actually helps the computer make serious life-threatening mistakes. So,
oh, perfect.
I guess you could say automation is a concern. I mean, we have to live with it. I just hope people aren't complacent.
What do you see about this, you know, this unique identification number that India has decided to implement over its entire 1.1, 1.2 billion person population? How do you see that? Have you given any thought or had an opportunity to get into the ramifications of a system like that once it's fully implemented and it's up and running? What might happen if there's a system failure in that regard?
Well, I have not looked at that, John. That's interesting. But can't you say that a cellular phone is sort of a unique number? That I wrote an article on telephones, and I said, you know, one day we'll have a phone number that we have all our life, and I didn't realize it'd be a cell phone number.
It's liable to be your Social Security number.
Well, and they're awfully similar. I mean, if somebody knows your cell phone, they can find out an awfully lot. They find out more than they can from your Social Security. They can essentially track where your phone is and know where you are. So I think we might have some of the same concerns here. I'm not sure if India has a lock on that kind of loss of privacy leading to maybe loss of independence. That just happens day by day.
Well, this has been a lot of fun in a quick hour. We're just about out of time here, but tell us quickly, where can we find your books?
They're still in print. Amazon would be a good place. And I encourage people to stay in touch through my blog, DisasterWise, at the Blogspot location. And I give talks. You can always reach me through the Blogspot. That's probably the best way, or the God Machine website. I maintain that website, the God Machine. So if you love helicopters, then check out the God Machine.
You know, I love helicopters, but I thought maybe I'd save something for later because, I don't know, having that between the two controls, I don't know. I'm just afraid that I might have a system interruption. Thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
And come back again soon.
Good.
This is Coast to Coast AM for the next 3 hours. Your calls and Dr. Lawrence Krauss. Stand by for this one. It'll be big.